I'm Bob, an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
Join me in a moment of silence, and I want to open with a little meditation or prayer. I am the place where God shines through. Him and I are one, not two. I need not worry, fret, or plan. He wants me where and as I am. And if I can be relaxed and free, he'll carry out his plan through me. Amen. Well, some of you came back. I don't know if I would have, but that's cool. If you have your cell phone on, turn it to silence, please. Because you'll save yourself the grief of when it goes off in the meeting, everybody turning and staring at you. It's squirmy. There are just about three or four things are going through my head. I can't share any of them. So we're engaged in this process of shrinking ourselves and clearing away the things of and in ourselves that have been blocking us from other people, from God, and from going with this flow in the universe that is really the essence of what we're trying to achieve in step three, and then make in the decision in step three. So we talked about the house cleaning that we begin in step four, and that's not the end in itself. The next thing that we have to do is probably the first thing in the process that has a little bit of personal risk. Not nearly as much as step eight and nine, but and that's step five. But the book says, the book has a couple guidelines on how to pick somebody to do step five with. It says in two different places, it says we want a closed-mouthed, understanding person, someone who can keep a confidence. So, you know, if you go, you need to find someone who's not an avid gossip in AA. I ran into someone a couple years ago that was just whining in a meeting about how they took their fifth step with a certain person, and that person told somebody about something that was in their fifth step. And I pulled him aside. I said, but are you the only one in AA that doesn't know this person's like that? It was almost like they set themselves up for that to happen so they could be angry about the whole deal. I mean, everybody knew that this nice person, but they can't hold it. They leak like a sieve. I mean, it's not that they're not there's no malice behind it. They just do. And everybody knew that. And they picked that, of all the people they could have picked in AA, they picked the one person that leaked like a sieve. And so you really want to pick someone who's quiet enough within themselves that they're not going around talking crap about people all the time. And the other thing, it says someone who's not going to try to change your plan. When this book was written in 1939, the population of Alcoholics Anonymous worldwide was somewhere between 76 and 83 people, depending upon the historian you talk to. Now, I know it says in the beginning of the book it was the first 100. Well, you know, Bill's like all of us. It looks better to round up. You know, I mean, I get that. But in actuality, he was guessing, I think, when he said that. But in actuality, it was somewhere 76, 70 to 83. So when they wrote the book, they made a suggestion in there because they were going to ship these books out all over the world. And the suggestion was if you're in Adelaide and there's nobody sober in Adelaide yet, that you may have to take this with your minister or your priest or your counselor. It gives you a little warning. It says you don't want to take especially you don't want to discuss your sexual inventory with your mate. That's not a good idea. And use some discretion. And that was probably a pretty valid thing to say in 1939. 15 years later, when Bill wrote the 12 steps and the 12 traditions in step five, he brings it a little more up to standards of what happened in the fellowship. And now he's suggesting, because AA is in the thousands and it's spread all over the place, that that you might want to do it with someone who's been dry a while, someone who's familiar with your case, someone who's actually done this themselves. And he recommends your sponsor might be good for this. I think your sponsor is ideal for this. And I'll tell you why. If you take this, and I'm not to... If people that I sponsor come to me and they say, I would like to take my fifth step with a priest, I'll say, but you're going to take it with me too. And the reason you want to take it with your sponsor is you're going to run into some problems in the fifth step where you can't get free of certain resentments, or you'll get back into the eighth and ninth step and you're going to need some help on how not to shoot yourself in the foot in trying to make these amends. And you will need someone that, and the person that has listened to your fifth step is the ideal to help you with your eighth and ninth. So that's what he says. And he said, that's the best. That's the optimum. Take it with someone. Why do we take this though? Why? I mean, there's a place in the book, it says our real object is to enable you to connect with a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Okay. You can get a sense. Well, me and God are good now. So isn't that enough? No, it's not. Because of the tenaciousness and insidiousness of the alcoholic ego, how it will creep in and it masquerades itself. And we'll talk about that a little bit in step 11, is God's will. I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room that just hasn't imagined some pretty bizarre stuff was God's will. It was really your will. But you kind of fancy it could be God's will, maybe, hope. So I will always need someone outside of this and outside of me to filter my vision of God's will. I tell the guys I sponsor, if you get inspired by God, call me. If it's a big inspiration, come on over to the house. Well, because you know how we are, right? And I do the same thing. And I'm there's a tremendous comfort in bouncing my vision and the things I think I'm going to do or the decisions I'd like to make that I feel are right off my sponsor. And most of the time, and he's really very objective and very principle oriented, and he's never steered me wrong. I told him many years ago, I said, I'll do everything you ask me to do. You mess me up, I'm going to tell everybody. And he laughed. He thought that was funny. But I'll bounce things off of him today. And probably nine times out of 10, he'll say to me, that's exactly right. That's right. That's the right action to take. And every once in a while, he'll go, are you out of your goddamn mind? Right? And when he says it, and he'll start talking about it from a different perspective, it's like a veil lifts, and I go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's usually, he helps me to look at me and what I'm doing from an objective outside of me point of view. And he's very big on trying to get me as a way of life and as a perspective to look at my actions on how they would speak to the newer people. It's a big piece of business in our world. Because everything, we only, all of us, no matter how long we're sober, even if you're sober 50 years, you only really get one vote here. And your vote is what you do. It's not what you say. Your actions will speak volumes. Your words mean very little. And so if you're the person who comes to meetings late, and some people have legitimate reasons to do that, but your actions is speaking something here. It's speaking an okayness about coming to meetings late. If you leave your phone on and the phone rings in the meeting and you answer it in the meeting, you're really saying to everybody, I think this is good. It's almost like an encourage, because if you're sober more than a year or so, you may not want this to be true, but I'll tell you it is. The brand new people will look to you as an example on how to live your life, how to live their lives sober. And we have a lot of monkey see, monkey do here. I went through there have been times in my sobriety where I was really self-serving periods of that. I know that some of you find that hard to believe, but I was taking actions that I don't think are hurting anybody, there's nothing really wrong with this. Until I saw guys I sponsor emulate what I was doing. And then I was ashamed. Because I really didn't want them to emulate it. Not that it wasn't illegal or anything like that, but I didn't want to be that kind of example to them in alcoholics, because it was a self-serving example. And so my sponsor's been big on that. And so I encourage guys to take, and men and women to take their fifth step with their sponsor. This is your sponsor grows maybe more from your fifth step than you do. And you don't know that until you've listened to about a dozen of them. And you realize that I've gotten more out of fifth steps that I've from other people than I have. And stuff will cook out of me. A lot of the things I've shared this weekend are things that I've gotten realizations and consciousnesses that I've obtained by seeing myself in a way I've never seen myself through a guy I sponsor. It's a remarkable thing. You're listening to a fifth step and all of a sudden you go, oh my God, I did, and I never made the amends. Oh man, I've been buried 30 years and here I am. This guy's cooked it out of me right here. And I think he thinks I'm helping him. So do this with a sponsor. And the book has a couple reasons why. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on five. At the bottom of 72, it says the best reason first to do your fifth step, to take this risk of looking bad. So my dear friend who passed away a few years ago, Vince Yeo, used to say, sometimes you have to be willing to look bad in order to feel good. And the best reason first, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Remember drinking? Remember, it's easy to forget drinking. You can be sober 5-10 years and sort of settle into, oh, of course I'm sober. And you forget. Forget that you have a disease that if it turns back on you, you don't have the power to get back. This is a hideous disease. The most alcoholics that relapse themselves to death do it, and they don't have a clue how powerless they actually are, how this can get out from under you, and how you can't get the tiger back in the cage. And I see people for years come into Alcoholics Anonymous and with a cavalier attitude. Yeah, I know it's bad, and I'm going to get sober. But they don't really put the energy in, and they relapse again. Well, they come back, and they come back thinking, see, you know, it's not the end of the world. And, you know, they'll say things in meeting like, well, it's not like I'm really new. I had that time before. You know, you can feel the ego right there, right? And they never buy the whole package. And then one time they go out, and they can't get back. I think sometimes Alcoholics Anonymous is like, when you join AA, it's like joining the mafia. Nobody gets out of here alive. you know what I mean, right? I mean that's a pretty cold thing to say, but I don't know. If you're a real chronic alcoholic, it's probably true. So the best reason first, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. We're No matter how comfortable you are in abstinence, no matter how long it's been since you've even entertained, ever thought about drinking, you're never out of the woods. There's an old saying that I think it's kind of funny. It says the monkey may be off the off your back, but the circus is still in town. And that's really true. And it talks on page 73 about why this is important. Actually, we'll start at the bottom of 72. It says, time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Do you guys have that saying down here, you're as sick as your secrets?
Yep.
Yeah. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Oh, my God, we got a society that's throwing easier methods at us. And, you know, I'll tell you one thing that being sober a while, you know, several decades will give you. It doesn't make you smarter, but it gives you perspective. You watch all the different methods and easier ways to come and go, and they swagger and boast in AA for a number of years, and the body count starts to develop. And, you know, it's funny. I came here in 1978, one of the most liberal, you know, minded. I thought everything's good. All the 12-step programs should be together, and all the therapy should be in AA, and it's all good, and we should, you know, we should do it all. And over the years, the body count just cuts away crap. Until what's left after almost 3.5 decades is the only thing that works. You know, a guy doesn't go from a liberal anything goes attitude to a fundamentalist in Alcoholics Anonymous out of choice. It's out of pragmatism. It's because it's what's left. And it's really the thing here. You know, you can intellectual arguments about other methods can be very strong. But it's not a matter of who's right or wrong, it's a matter of who's left. It's not who's right, it's who's left. And if you had someone in your life that you really, really loved, your daughter, your son, your mate, your mother, your father, brother, sister, wouldn't you want them to get on the road that would have the maximum potential to change their life? Would you want to half measure and stuff? And yet, we will half measure for ourselves, but if it was somebody we really cared about, which is indicative, I think, of long-lasting feelings of low self-esteem that sometimes can go for decades and decades in sobriety. You get glimpses of it when you start to realize that you want more for the people you love than you do for yourself, right? How come I'll go out of my way to help you quit smoking, but I won't do it for me? How come I'll go out of my way to help you go to a doctor when you're sick, but I'll resist going? How come I'll go out of my way to help you go back to school, but I won't, right? And as if I care more about you than I care about me. And one of the great blessings in Alcoholics Anonymous is we link ourselves to each other. Something happens that is greater than us individually. And it's sponsoring people and having a sponsor is so important. I was up in the Rocky Mountains in the United States 20-some years ago at a little conference up there, and we had a day to kind of sightsee, and they took me up to this place where there's this mountain lake, and it was pristine. It was so pristine and so clear and pure that you could see the rocks on the bottom of the lake. That's how clear that water was. And I realized why it was clear. On one side of the lake, there was a rapid-moving stream with water bubbling in, pouring in. And on the other side of the lake, there was a stream with water going out. And consequently, it could never become stagnant because it flowed. I need that in my life. I need a sponsor where stuff's coming into me, and I need to sponsor people where stuff's going out. And if you're like me and you cut off either end of that, you start, what happens is the lake starts getting stagnant, which really means is it starts filling up with you, basically. And I need all of that. I need to be, as it talks about in this, in the 11th step St. Francis prayer, a channel where things flow through me. So the book says, invariably they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory, all right. This would have applied to me at 3.5, 4 years sober. I'd written 2 inventories, plus did some in treatment centers. They took inventory, all right, but they hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egotism and fear. They only thought they'd humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. One of the great things about step 4 and 5, as it's outlined in the book, this is not to discover the things you already know. This is to discover some of the things you don't know. And there was a therapist many years ago, maybe 40 years ago, who invented a thing called the Johari window. And it was a remarkable intellectual exercise. It was the things about you as a person. And the Johari window had 4 panes. The first pane was a pane that was crystal clear. You could see through it in both directions. And that was what I know I can see about me and what you can see about me. It's a clear pane. The second pane was like one of those panes with a reflective thing on one side where you can see through one way, but you can't see through the other. And that was the things I know about me, but I'm not going to let you see. I'm going to keep them in the shade. And then the third pane was the beginning of the insidious pains, and that was things that you could see about me, but I don't see them. I can't see me the way you see me. And this is one of the pains that's cleared, made clear, or should be partially made clear in step 4 and 5. And then the last pain is the pain of the things that I can't see about me and you can't see about me. These are the things when it talks about in the 12 steps and 12 traditions that can bubble to the surface later and handicap you in relationships and other areas of your life. It's sometimes the stuff I don't know about me that hurts me the most. So we have the things that come out in the open in step 4 and 5 that my secrets come out, of course. And then as I start to shift in my perception, as it talks about on page 66 and 67, I start to make these realizations. I start to see the things about me that other people saw that I could never see. And what happens for some of us is when you uncover that stuff, it brings a little light and a little grace into your life and helps cook out the stuff from the fourth pane, the stuff that you don't know about yourself and nobody else knows about yourself. It starts to bubble out to the surface. And this is an ongoing process. When it says in the vision for you that more will be disclosed, it's because it has been closed to me. And it cooks out. And everybody that I know in sobriety has that as an ongoing experience. I know the stuff, it's kind of funny really, but I know stuff about myself today that I can see very clearly that I could not see 10 years ago. And there was stuff 10 years ago that I could see that I couldn't see 10 years prior to that. Which means, if I'm objective, that there's some stuff about me today that I can't see that I think is a certain way that 10 years from now I'm going to think I'm an idiot today. Right? And when you get that, it's pretty hard to maintain this position where you know stuff, because you get to know that you don't know. Right? And you don't. It's an illusion. It's an illusion of the ego that you know something. We have our experience. And that is changed by life itself continually. And that's really all I have is of any value is my experience. That's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the things I know or my opinions, but my experience. And it starts to talk about this compartmentalization that seems to be driven by self-centered fear. It says more than most people, the alcoholic will lead a double life, sometimes triple, sometimes quadruple lives. Some of you may have had the experience where you're one person to your minister, another one to your parents, another one to your wife or husband, another one at work, another one to your drug dealer, another one to your bartender. I mean, is it any wonder most of us come here, we don't even know who we are. I mean, I don't know who I am anymore. I mean, I've been so many things to so many people. Who the hell am I? I mean, you know, I don't know. So we live this double life. And why do I do that? Because I'm afraid. I'm afraid of what you'll think of me. If you're like me and you go through life with a tremendous, overwhelming sense of not enoughness, a feeling of inadequacy, and you cover it up behind a facade because you so desperately want people to love you and accept you, and you're afraid they won't, then the fear pushes guys like me into a position of being something I'm not. Out of the fear of that you wouldn't love, if you knew me, you wouldn't love me. Because, you know, I don't. Not really. So I have to be something I'm not. And I think we die in that abyss. If there is a hell on earth, I think it must surely exist in the abyss that opens up between who I want the world to think I am and who I secretly know I am inside. And my grand sponsor used to say, you cannot compartmentalize your life. You have to be one person. And this is the beginning of unity. And this is the beginning of integrity. Integrity just means being of one mind. It means that I'm the same guy at work that I am in the grocery store, that I am in traffic, that I am in AA, I'm the same guy. Not perfect in any one of these, but the same guy. I am me in every one of these. But one of the promises in step 9 is that we will know a new freedom. I think a big piece of that freedom, part of it is the freedom from fear because we're starting to trust God. But another piece of it is the freedom that comes when you don't have to do anything except be who you are. When you're trying to be something you're not, oh my God, you're a hostage to that up here. Now I have to remember you. I have to remember the lies I told you last week, right? I have to, you know, I'm a hostage to that. So this is an amazing thing. On page 75, this is the part coming out of the fifth step experience, and it says bottom of the page. It says, "Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done." So I just finished my fifth step with my sponsor, and I was at his house, or maybe I was in a park, or maybe I took a drive in his car or whatever, and I've come home. I found some place where I can be quiet for an hour. No telephone. I'm not texting anyone. I'm just me and my fourth step and God. Okay? The first thing I do is after I look back over the fourth step, I review carefully what I've just done. And then after I do that, I say this prayer. I thank God from the bottom of my heart that I know Him better. Remember, we're entering into this is an exercise of uncovering, discovering, and discarding the things between me and God. Now, you may, because self-centered people such as myself have a tendency to gauge everything on how I feel, I may not feel like saying this prayer that I thank God as I know Him better, because maybe I don't feel like I know Him better. Maybe I just feel tired. I mean, I just sat and talked about my whole life for about 4 to 6 hours. Maybe I just feel washed out. And a guy asked me a few years ago, he said, "Well, what if you don't feel like you know God better? What should you do?" And And he stumped me, and I looked in the book, and what's it? I said, you know, it doesn't say we thank from God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better if we feel like it. So maybe I'm trusting in the process. And taking this book down from the shelf, I turned to the page which contains the 12 steps in chapter 5, carefully reading the first 5 steps. So not only have I looked over my 4th and 5th step, I'm looking over this preceding step 1, 2, and 3. And there's another prayer here. And this is an important prayer. We ask. Anytime the book says we ask, I mean, they're not saying you're asking your head. It's a prayer. We ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. At least 15 times, I imagine, over the years, I've sent a guy home to do what it talks about on page 75 and 76, and 45 minutes later, I'll get a phone call. And because when you get alone with God and you ask that question, you're looking over your 4-step, it's not unusual that something will just cook up to the surface. Do you ever see those 8 balls where you shake them up, you ask it a question, shake it up, and you turn it upside and there's nothing there, and then all of a sudden an answer floats to the top? It's kind of like that. And I've had guys call me 45 minutes later. I'll be sitting at home. Not unusual. Guy calls me and says, Bob, I forgot to tell you about the sheep. I'm going to want you to send a check to the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals every month for a while, and for your amends. It could be something really crazy. We stuff that's horrifying to us, we'll bury it very deeply. I had a guy call me up one time, and he said, I forgot to tell you that I stole some money from where I work. I said, really? I said, how much? He said, $450,000. Yeah, I'd forget that too, I think. Yeah, your ego's read ahead, knows about step 8 and 9. I'd forget that one also, I think. All I could say to it is, oh, we're going to have some fun. The book says, the top of 76, if we can answer to our satisfaction all those questions on the bottom of 75, the mortar's in place. The first 5 steps are good. Not perfect. We're not talking perfect here. We're talking, is there anything left undone that I could do right now? Can I see anything that I could do? And if you go, no, I may not be perfect, but I did the best I could. Good. Then you've answered to your satisfaction. We then look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. And here is the question. Are you now ready? Ready is a big word. Are you now ready to let God remove from you all, I hate that word, all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? My capacity for self-delusion is astonishing. I convinced myself that I was ready to let go of things that I wasn't really ready to let go of. In truth, I was ready to have God take away the consequences, but I wanted to hold on to the attitudes and the behaviors and the thing and the what these things really are defective defense mechanisms that I've used to protect self and my ego for years. And at one time, possibly some of them worked. At one time, there was maybe my anger did and my rage did save me from getting in trouble and it backed somebody off. Maybe when I was a little kid, having a temper tantrum got my way with my parents. In your 20s, temper tantrums don't work anymore. And yet I'm still the guy ranting and raving and kicking stuff around when I don't get my way. Maybe maybe at one time in my life, got being a gossip and tearing other people down gave me an illusion of being a little better than I was, or of being okay. It's sort of that dumbwaiter effect. You know, I'll pull you down and maybe I come up, right? And maybe at one time, there was that might have got, I might have done something or gave me the illusion it was I was a little better. But now, years later, it's just making me more and more alone. And I, you know what you know what happens to every single one of us. This isn't it's so funny. I go through my whole life caught in this cause and effect, and I can't see it. That. And the cause and effect is what my action. I always end up unconsciously feeling about myself the way I would feel about someone else that was doing what I'm doing. So if I'm a gossip and I'm tearing down people, what happens is I end up feeling about myself the way I'd feel about someone who does that to everybody. And, you know, I never liked that in people. And I think it's as if my ego thinks it can escape the cause and effect. It's like my ego appreciates the laws of cause and effect. It just thinks it's above them. And it's like the speed limit. I think the speed limit's a good idea. I mean, it's really, that's important. But I'm in a hurry. You know, the handicapped parking, that's important. There are people really need to get those spaces. But I'm only going to be a minute. I think the ego thinks it loves rules for others. It just doesn't love them for me. And that's an immature consciousness that I'm so self-centered, I can't even see the cause and effect in my life. And then I wonder why I'm depressed. I wonder why I'm a depressive. Because I'm doing stuff that depresses me. I mean, why do I have all this self-pity and self-loathing and I beat myself up? Because I'm acting like someone I'd like to beat the crap out of is what I am. It's right? Internally, I'm acting like the guy I don't like. So it's an inescapable cause and effect. If someone would have done to my mother and father what I did to my mother and father, I think I would have killed them. Is it any wonder I was so self-destructive? So we're trying to become entirely ready. And this is more than consequences. The ego is willing to have the consequences removed. Bill Wilson, in his story... So I heard someone say this, and I very rarely ever hear people in AA mention this, but I was just in a meeting one night here, and I can't remember who, some woman said, I can't remember who it was. I was very impressed. She quoted the part from Bill's story where he says he asked his creator to take these things away, root and branch. Now, what does he mean by root? Like, is there two parts to a defect? I think so. I think there's the branch is the thing that's poking me in the eye, the thing that's the consequences, the thing that's obviously objectionable. But there's the root. And the root is that secret, illusional thing that provides value, security, comfort, or self-gratification, or self-grandizement. And I want the branches to be taken, but I want to keep the root. But it is the root. And the problem is if you just keep cutting off the branches by making amends and you never change the root, it keeps growing back, right? It keeps coming back. And that's why it's not unusual. You know, you're 10 years sober and you realize, I'm still doing stuff I did. I've changed the places and the faces, but it's kind of the same because the root hasn't changed. And this becoming entirely ready is a big deal. I think the sixth step is really the story of my entire sobriety. One of the guys I sponsor, he calls step six the Judas step. That means if you're 10 years sober and something in your program has betrayed you, it's step six. You think you did it and you haven't. I'm surprised how many times I take guys, we go, they think they're some advanced step 10, 11, and 12 program and how we have to come back to six, that there's some stuff here you're not entirely ready to have God remove. You're not ready to give up yet because there's an illusion of value in them. And there's a lot of fear. My sponsor, he says, it's a great story. He says, you come to AA and you're beaten half to death by the bottle, so you throw the towel in. And then when you're a couple months sober, you have just enough self-esteem to be dangerous, you sneak the towel back. And you'll spend the rest of your sobriety ripping off, when you have to, little pieces and throwing them into the abyss. As like some kind of your tithing, you know. But nobody wants to throw the whole towel in. Not once we get it back. And so how do guys like me become entirely ready? Well, in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, it sort of speculates. It asks that question, how come God never takes away all of our defects and renders us white as snow? And then it speculates, it says, isn't it possibly because we don't hit the same desperate bottom with lust, with anger, with judgment, with gossip, with all the other self-serving defense mechanisms that we had hit with alcohol? And alcohol really and truly was a defense mechanism in a sense. It secured me in the world. It gave me the power to live. It was a great thing when it worked. So I don't hit the same bottoms with these defects. So what do you do? Well, there's a prayer here. I didn't see this prayer. When I was a little over 4 years, between 4 and 5 years sober, and I was going back through the steps, I skipped the six-step prayer and I said the seven-step prayer. I didn't see it because there wasn't anything in the margin with a big neon arrow that said prayer, and I didn't see it, but it says, if we still, the bottom, the last line in the first paragraph, if we still cling to something, we will not let go. If you're still continuing to the same behavior, and maybe you've altered it a little bit, trying to control and enjoy your deal. I think what happens to some of us is we get smart, we think we're smart, so I want to continue this, but I'm going to do it a little bit different. I'm not going to drink the vodka. I'm going to stick to rum with a little bit of amphetamine so I don't black out. This will work good. This is going to be good. This is going to be good. And you just, right, control and enjoy your sobriety. So we ask God to help us to be willing. I didn't say that prayer. And here's what happened to me from the time I was 5 years sober to... continued for a while, actually. I thought it was my job to rid myself of my character defects. I started willfully attacking them because I want to be good. I want to be able to go to the I want to go to the meeting rights and have the. I want to go to the meetings and have the bragging rights of having a guy who's spirit. I want to be the guy who's spiritual, but still be squirmy underneath, you know, that kind of thing. I want to. I want the reputation, but I don't want to change. I want the relief from not having the consequences, but I don't want to change. And I had a lot of tough years. I discovered there's a line later on in the book where it talks about a cause and effect, and it says it's referring to drinking. But I believe in my experience the same thing's true of defects of character. It says that if we try to willfully do this stuff, what happens is we end up with a bigger explosion than ever. It's almost as if whatever I suppress gains torque. And it's like I'll be good for a while until I just kind of outgood myself or something. It's like a slingshot effect. I'll go the other way because I put torque on it. It's in what you become the reformed whatever. You know, you were the person who had all these terrible relationships. You were a serial monogamist, or you slept with a lot of people. And okay, you're never going to do that again. And now you go around and you're judging. You're the intolerant, judgmental person of everyone else's sexual behavior. You're just as hostage to it as when you were doing it. In the Tao, it says the chains that bind us most closely are the ones we think we've broken. Or the reformed smoker who's always going, you know, that's killing you. It's killing everybody. Jumping in people's faces. He's as hostage to the cigarettes as the guy who still says when he was still smoking. That's not freedom. Freedom is inside and it's independent. So I became that. I have to give one example. This stuff is devious. It's tricky. I sat there and I looked over my resentment list after I did the fifth step, and it was pathetic. Now, I'm sober a number of years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and most of the resentments are people in AA. And they didn't do anything. They're just being them. I mean, you know, I built cases on people based on, it's just all a pathetic, childish view of life, really. And I just remember thinking to myself, oh my God, I'm so pathetically judgmental. And I didn't like it. Now that I'm looking at it, I don't feel any better. I don't like that. I don't like it in other people, and I don't like it in me. And I made a decision to willfully not be that way anymore. And almost instantaneously, I started noticing the judgmental people in AA. You know? And so I'm judging the judgmental, which makes me exactly like them. It's just kind of, isn't that funny how it just kind of, the ego's need to puff itself up by looking down on people, it just took a different form, that's all. Just took a different form. I've sponsored guys that have had terrible sex problems, and they go from pornography, and then, okay, I can't ever do that again. Then they go to hookers, and, oh, yeah, I can't hit a bottom on that. I can't do that anymore. And I'll go to, you know, it's changing deck chairs on the Titanic, you know. Because that's not freedom. That's self. That's will. That's the will. God really has to do this. And the thing is, the reason that I have to be entirely ready is that it's a partnership. There's an old adage that without him, I can't. I don't have the power. But without me, he won't. And it's I have to be willing, and he provides the power. It's a partnership in this stuff. He will not, because his first gift to me was free will, he won't take anything away from me that I'm holding on to. And I have to be honest and genuine about myself, about what I'm holding on to. If you in your mind think I'm really ready to get rid of this, and 3 years later you're still doing it, you better relook at how ready you really are, right? Because the other way to go is to blame God. Well, God didn't like me when he took it, you know. I don't believe that. I think the problem in the machine is always within me. And there's a humanness about this. I mean, one of the things that's such a saving grace for me that I don't have to go hang myself is what Bill wrote in chapter 5 when he said, no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. And that gives me the breathing room to be as flawed as I am. And to know that, you know, oh my God, Bob, you're 33 and a half years sober and you're still self-centered. Yes, I know. People come up to me sometimes as if they're going to give me information that's new. They'll say, do you know you're self-centered? You just figured that out? I mean, I'm... on. And isn't it funny how we start to wear who we are like a loose garment? It's a tattered, sometimes, loose garment. It's not a perfect loose garment, but it is our loose garment. One of the beautiful things that happens to most of us in AA is you get to a point where you, truthfully, you're not perfect, and you know there's some areas that would be really very cool if they would change. You'd like to be less selfish and more considerate, and you'd like to be a better listener, and you'd like to, you know, on and on and on and on. You see all these areas where you could like to improve, but at the same time, in the imperfection, there's a very comfort because you really like who you are. Not perfect, but I like who I am. And that's kind of cool. And that's something that will allow you to put your head on the pillow at night and sleep. That's something that allows you to get up in the morning and feel free to walk through the day and respond to life. That's the freedom I found in the bottle. And it's the freedom you can find in Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw a TV show when I was a little kid that really exemplified step six. And it was brilliant. You probably didn't get this show here. Maybe you did, I don't know. It was called Rescue 8. I don't know if you guys, it was put out by Universal Studios, and it was a weekly half-hour television show, and it was about these two paramedics that worked out of a firehouse, and they would go out on distress calls, people that were in trouble, and they'd help those people. And this one particular episode, these two paramedics get to this site, and there's this little cute little girl in distress, and her arm is wedged into a vending machine, and they try to get it out, and it's hurting her. It's really stuck in there, and it's stuck. You can't get her out. And she's crying hysterically, and her mother and father are there, and they're very upset. And the fire trucks start pulling up, and off of the fire trucks, they're pulling like torches, like acetylene torches and saws and stuff, and it's flipping this little girl out. I mean, she's really getting scared now. And the one paramedic's just watching all this, and he's watching the little girl. And he walks over and he kneels down next to her, so they're eyeball to eyeball, and he says to her, he says, "Sweetheart, do you got something in your hand?" She goes, "Uh-huh." "What do you got in your hand?" "Candy bar." "Would you let go?" "No, it's my candy bar. It's my candy bar. It's my candy bar. It's my candy bar." He just realizes she ain't having none of it. He backs away. And he comes back a minute later and kneels down to her. He says, "Sweetheart, I'll make you promise." She said, "What?" "If you'll let go of that candy bar, I'll get you two candy bars." She says, "Really?" He says, "I promise you, really." And because she trusts him, she lets go of the candy bar and her arm slides out of the vending machine. "What is your candy bar? You don't hold on to destructive, objectionable behavior because you're destructive. There's a secret value or gratification or an illusion of self-grandizement or security in the behavior. And that's why I hang on to that stuff. Because maybe one time it worked. But when I can see the truth, and this is what happens to guys like me when I say this prayer, when I ask God to help me to be willing, is that I start to wake up. And sometimes waking up to behavior and what this really means, and waking up to and seeing through the delusion that this isn't helping. This is making me more alone. This is making me more depressed. This is not enhancing my life, even though you had a delusion that it was. You start to wake up to the cause and effect. It's like I went through a period right after my first divorce, from 11 years sober to probably 15 years sober, where I dated a lot of people. I was like a serial monogamist, and I had all the trappings while I'm being honest, and all. I told everybody I don't really want a relationship. A bunch of crap. Because self-gratification through using another person, it's what it's like. Do you guys know what Disneyland is? Disneyland in Orlando, Florida. If you were to go there on the 4th of July, which is the big summer holiday at Disneyland, and you went there to ride one of the most popular rides, say Space Mountain, on the 4th of July, first of all, it's probably your equivalent of 40 degrees centigrade. It's probably over 100 degrees. The humidity in Orlando is about 100%. I mean, it's brutal. You're in a steam room, right? You're in line for 4 or 5 hours with 5,000 kids that have overdosed on sugar. You're there for 4 or 5 hours. You think you are in hell. There are times in the line where you just think, I should just kill myself. And you do all of that for 30 seconds of excitement on the ride. Now, self-gratification is the mirror image. We're going to give you the 30 seconds up front, and you're going to feel like crap for a long time. And the problem is, people like us don't see past the 30 seconds of fun. Right? We don't see. We have this major insanity. The book talks about it in reference to our drinking. It says it's a queer mental blank spot. It says insanity is, I love the definition, it says insanity is a complete lack of proportion and an inability to think straight. I can't see the consequences. All I can see is the fun. Right? And if you say this prayer, here's what happened to me. I just started waking up to some stuff. I started realizing I started recoiling from certain things as from a hot flame, because I don't just see the fun, I see the aftermath. I get it. I get that this is like paying money to feel bad. I get it that this is like going down a road that the end of that road is nothing but depression. I get it. You know, you start seeing the cause and effect. And that can be true from anything from gambling to sex to anger to gossip to anything that a guy like me will do to puff myself up, to fill up the squirmy little dark vacant spots in my life. And does it work? Isn't that the bottom line? Does it work? The great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is AA would never even propose to ask you to even consider giving something up that's really good. We're asking you to give up stuff that's defective. If this really did enhance you and fill your vacancies and make you closer to being complete and more loving and more, if it really enhanced your life, it would never show up on a fourth and fifth step. It would never show up. These are not the things that complete you. And we're cutting away everything that decimates you is being cut away. We're cutting away all the corruption, everything that really and truly is not you anyway. You know, Michelangelo was asked one time how he did his great sculptures, the David, and a very nice guy gave me a book of, I love Michelangelo, and his response was brilliant. He says, I don't know. I just take a block of this white marble and I cut away everything that's not David. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. What you're left with is, to your surprise, is what was been you all along. And one of my great friends he died a few years ago, Don Pritz, used to say that the alcoholic is like a magnet that's drugged through the junkyard of life. And we pick up all this crap that's not us anyway. It's not us. And we have it, but we think we're so scared because of all the crap. We think it is us. We hang on to this stuff. It's not us. It's not us. Never was. So God has his way with us. You ask him to be willing, buckle in. because stuff's going to start happening. You're going to start waking up to stuff. You keep this as a legitimate piece of business and things will change. And you can measure your willingness by how much of a piece of business your defects are with God. I can sit here, and this will sound bizarre, but I can guarantee you that if you're like me, and you put as much time and energy into with AA and your sponsor and the steps and God, and you make it as big a piece of business, this defect of character that you're struggling with, as you had with drinking when you got sober, I'm telling you, you'll get free of it. But most of us don't want to bring it up to that level. We don't want to take it to that level. I have this tremendous. I have some areas in my life. The truth is, I'm not quite ready to. I don't want to get too pure yet. I mean, someday you'll be able to touch the hem of my garment, but not yet. Not yet. That's okay. In the alkalogic, the discomfort from some of that stuff, it seems it's minimal, and I can live with. It's not that big a deal to me. But I know, because I've experienced it, if these things start to really bug me, if I make it a persistent piece of spiritual business every day with God, it'll go. Because I did it with gambling. I did it with the stock market, where I hadn't placed a bet in 25 years, and I retired and I had several million dollars to play around with, and I thought, This is the voice of my enemy. It said to me, "Well, you should invest some of that in the market." Another little voice said, "Bob, but you know, Bob, you don't gamble. You can't gamble." "Well, it's not gambling. It's investing." Well, it started out like that. You know, 6 months later, I'm on the computer 6-8 hours a day trading stocks. I got $1.5 million on margin, which will make you crazy as you watch your portfolio jump $500,000 a day up and down. I mean, and I could. And here's the frightening thing. I was so addicted to it, I couldn't stop. I knew I should. I get it. This is making me sick. I had a guy sponsor bust me. Oh, it was humiliating. He calls me up, and I got the phone. And I'm like, "Trades." Got the phone. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. He's telling me about something that's very important to him. And he says to me, and all of a sudden he stops, and he goes, "What's that noise?" He said, "That's the keyboard, isn't it?" I said, "No, I was looking at something while we're talking." He says, "You're trading stocks, aren't you?" Well, a little bit, but I'm listening. He says, "What did I just say?" I had egg all over my face. It was horrible. It was, oh my God, I was just so ashamed of myself. I thought, oh my God, what have I become here? Right after that, I started asking God every morning, "Please take this from me. Take this from me." It took 6 months. 6 months of having a conversation with God at least once a day and talking to my sponsor and telling him, "I got to get free of this." And he said, "Just keep praying about it. Keep praying about it." 6 months. I'll tell you, it was amazing. I got up one morning and it was like when I quit smoking. I woke up one day and you just know something's happened. I walked right over to the computer and I sold everything in my portfolio, everything in my, just, I don't even care if it's up, down, I sold it all. And it happened to be a day the market was up exceptionally, which was very, I would have sold it if it was down, honest to God, I was ready. I was done. I could feel it. It was like I woke up. I had been asking God for 6 months, maybe, for the desire not to smoke. And I woke up one morning, and I remember telling God, I said, I'm not going to have that first cigarette. I ain't quitting because I ain't going to do that to myself. But I don't really feel like the first one. And I thanked him. I said, "Thank you." And I haven't had a cigarette since. See, the power really is there. I think some of us don't go at it because we don't. Our God's too small. You believe the fear that you believe the I can't. And the truth is, you're right. I often think my feelings of inadequacy are just good judgment. Because I can't. But there is a power. There is one who has all power. What an amazing sense of security to know that that power's there and that power loves me. And the only thing that will ever be in the way of my accessing it will be me. And I will be in the way. And I'll be in the way a lot. Doesn't make me a bad guy. God doesn't not love me for it or anything. It just, I get in the way. And what a tremendous security to know that that's there. It's almost like being sent into a schoolyard where you're afraid of getting in fights with the kids there, and right behind you at all times is Mike Tyson, and just whispering in your ear, one of those kids touches you, I'm cleaning his clock. You could walk around that schoolyard thinking, you wouldn't be afraid of nothing. I got the creator of the universe. He's got my back. That's beautiful. That's it allows me to jump out in life. It allows me to take risks. It allows me to step out. Very much like alcohol used to allow me to do things. You know, it gave me a freedom. Freedom to take risks. When you're like me and you go through life and a lot of your life you're locked up in fear, it robs you from everything, doesn't it? It robs you from love, relationships. Well, what if it doesn't work? Who cares? Take a shot. Business opportunities. Well, what if it doesn't work? You'll learn something. It gives you a freedom that's remarkable. Knowing that even if there is no failure, there's only next. There's no failure. There's just next. Right? It's beautiful. So we get to the seven-step prayer. Let's say this, and then I think it'll be time for a break.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. If you want to say this with me. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. That is the first amen in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Starting on page 63 was a prayer with no amen. And then throughout the whole four step is one prayer right after. If you were to follow the timeline in the big book, you're never very far away from. It's almost like you never really stop praying. You're carrying God right through this thing as you ask him. In every part of the four step, there's a prayer. And this is the amen. And one of the guys I sponsor, he tells a story. He said that most of you know. He said that and when you make the decision in step three, it's like the old adage that there are three frogs sitting on a log. One of them makes a decision to jump in the water. How many are on the log? And some new guys will go, well, two. And the old timer goes, no, you silly thing, you. Still three because he only made the decision. Well, my sponsee Sheldon says, if you really became entirely ready and did step seven, that's where you hear the splash. That's where you hear the splash. What a beautiful prayer. Bill Wilson amazes me that he's an egomaniac like we all are. He's self-centered like we all are. And yet he has brilliant insights into selflessness that run contrary to the alcoholic mind, and they had to have come from God. Because I would have never written a prayer like this. I don't think most of you wouldn't. I mean, listen to this. take away every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness. I wouldn't have said that. I would have said stands in the way of me being rich and famous, or everybody realizing how what amazing guy Bob is, or that's at least, at the very least, wouldn't you say it stands in the way of my happiness? But the inspiration of God through Bill Wilson when he wrote this book, it was outside of him. That I'm asking to take away the things that stand in the way of my usefulness. And here's the beauty of that. I have known happiness. It is fleeting. Usefulness will carry you through. There's a usefulness will give you a feeling inside of you that you can walk the streets with, where you know there's a rightness about you and a rightness about life, because you're in usefulness, you're fulfilling the purpose you've been divinely created for, and that's to help other people. I would rather feel useful than happy, because it's more concrete. You can walk with usefulness. Happiness is just comes and goes, like a butterfly. Let's take a break.